Welcome to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm your host, Hopeton Hay. Diverse Voices Book Review features interviews with authors of engaging novels and story collections and authors of nonfiction that address some of the most critical issues of our past, present, and future. My guest today is Joey Day, author of Fix It, his sixth mystery featuring amateur sleuth Isaiah Quintabi, also known as IQ. Joey Day grew up in South Central Los Angeles. His IQ series has won the Anthony, Seamus, and McCavity Awards. The IQ books are currently in development as an original TV series. And welcome back, Joe.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
So, Joe, as I was reading this book, what came to my mind was that Isaiah was having an existential crisis.
Yes.
And that was a continuation from the previous novel. So what I wanted to start off with is you to talk a little bit about the arc of that character, because there is a definite arc through this series and the character of Isaiah. So why don't you give our audience a view of that arc?
Well, I at the beginning, I wanted the characters to grow from book to book. I wanted them to confront problems that we all go through, you know, and he ages during the series. And so with each book, I wanted him to advance as a character, along with the other characters too. And Isaiah starts the series as a very, very lonely man. He's a teenager at the time, but he's extremely lonely. He's very isolated. And when he's an adult, that continues. His trauma has been such that it separated him from other people, except for his cases. And as he moves through the series, he starts very slowly to break out of that. You know, and the other characters are growing too. You know, in the beginning of the book, Dodge is a stone hustler. No, he's very self-involved. He's opportunistic. He doesn't think of anybody but himself. But as the series goes on, he marries Charisse, you know, somebody who helps him be a man. And then they have a baby, you know? And so I'm moving all the characters forward. Deronda starts off as a stone homegirl, you know, but as we go through the series, we find out she's a hell of a businesswoman. And by the time we reach Fix It, she's doing great. She has 8 food trucks. She's got money. She's taking care of her kids. She's just she's doing so well. So that was my plan. But by the time Isaiah reaches Fix It, he's gone through so many personal and challenging confrontations with criminals, especially so much violence, so many close calls, so many association with people who are just completely inhumane. By the time we reach Fix It, he is burned out. He is burned out. And he has a PTSD. He wants to no longer be IQ. He wants to drop that all together. He's seen enough. And when Grace, in this book, his true love, is kidnapped, that is what brings him out of it. That is what snaps him out of his illness.
What I really like about what you have done is showing the impact on IQ, showing the impact on Grace, because in a lot of the novel series, the crime fiction series I read over the years, many, many years, I always wondered why some of these protagonists and their friends didn't seem to really be impacted or traumatized by all the violence that was happening around them. So I really feel that you were really true to the true trauma. Now, has your experience been over the years, without naming names, whether dead or alive, that did you see that challenge with some of the crime fiction series over the many, many years you've been reading them and said, I want to make sure that my protagonist develops in a manner that reflects the trauma he's faced?
Yes, that's exactly what happened to me. That's exactly right. I'm reading a lot of crime fiction, probably the same books as you have. And here's the hero. He shoots 3 people, in the next scene, he's in a bar drinking a martini. That does not happen. That just does not happen. know, violence, trauma changes who you are. It changes how you see the world. You know, if even if you're shot at, and I've been shot at, you become much more wary, much more suspicious of your fellow man. You know, it gives you a sense of wariness all the time. It may be low level, but it's there all the time. And I wanted the readers to see the effects of violence, that neither the victimizer or the victim gets away scot-free. You know, everybody, unless you're a complete sociopath, is affected psychologically and emotionally.
So let's talk a little bit about his love interest, Grace. This is not her first appearance in the IQ novel. She's, I believe, the roommate of Deronda, who has the great down-home buttermilk fried chicken. And I'm going to have to ask you, is there a model for that in the L.A. area, down-home buttermilk fried chicken that you personally have sampled? But Grace is an artist. They've been together a couple of books, but the strain of that relationship is the work that IQ does. And Grace is really, truly impacting Grace. But talk a little bit about the arc of Grace, starting off as an artist, roommate of Deronda, becomes a love interest. And then IQ's going to do his things. Because once again, and a lot of, say, the TV series, the romantic partner of the protagonist is incredibly patient, waiting,
and
seems not to be impacted by all the trauma going around with the, you know, with the boyfriend / husband. So you, once again, even with the romantic partner, you're bringing this real sense of reality to it.
Oh yes. I you know, the story itself and the scenes may be fictional, but I try to bring honest emotion to those scenes. And Grace, as you say, starts off as an artist. She is lonely and sad, like Isaiah. And they meet, and there is a connection over that sadness, over their past tragedies. And they're so socially inept. It takes a long time and experiencing terrible things together and coming out of them that brings them together. So Isaiah is continuing his life as an unlicensed PI. He's getting through all these violent situations. And she is, as you say, waiting, wondering, you know, if he's going to be killed, if he's going to come home at all. And it's just disrupting her life separate from his. She is an artist and she needs peace and she needs to be able to focus, which she cannot do with Isaiah. And then violence from his world spills over into hers. And she just can't deal. Totally understand. So they break up.
Dotson, in the first book, like you said, his partner, was one scamming dude, was always out on the take. And this is a character through the love of Charisse, who has reformed himself, but he uses some of those skill sets from being a hustler to even solve church conflicts. What inspired you to bring church conflicts to Fix It?
Well, to start, in the last book, Dotson is being berated by Charisse about being unemployed. And in this book, she puts her foot down. You know, you have to do something, and or I'll kick you out of the house. And he's horrified by that idea. He has a young son. And in the last book, he said, I want to be a fixer. So in this book, in Fix It, his wife is going, well, go out and fix something. And he complains that, how do I let people know, you know, that I'm a fixer, you know, given my resume of crime and joblessness. And then she says, I have a problem. You know, she's a regular church goer, and her pastor has a really a knotty problem. It sounds petty, but these two women are longtime members of the church, are competing for who becomes choir director, and the reverend is supposed to choose. And the feud comes to blows. You know, these two elderly women slug it out, and he's horrified, and people in the congregation are taking sides. We want so-and-so to be choir director, we want so-and-so, and it's really splitting the congregation. And he's terribly upset. He doesn't know what to do. All he knows is that his congregation is breaking up over this feud. So Charisse has told the reverend, my husband has unusual skills. For one, conflict resolution. You know, if you're in a cell in Vacaville and you've got a big old dude there, it behooves you to be able to solve a conflict. Or if you have partners and you're selling drugs, somebody has to step in and go, okay, let's be sensible. And Dodson is also creative in terms of how he approaches problems. And so Reverend Arnall, he hears this theoretically. He calls Dodson in and says, I want you to settle this. I want you to settle this competition between these two elderly women who both want to be choir director. You know, it may seem petty, but my congregation has fallen apart. And so because of Charisse, Dodson is forced to take on this problem. And he has a time of it.
I like the way you have these background stories that sort of relieve the tension of the main theme of the story, you know, the trauma, the conflict, the, you know, the near-death experiences, all the things that are going on. But then you make sure as a background, you continue to clue us in on the day-to-day real life ups and downs of the characters that you have there. And one of the things I thought was really interesting is looking at the antagonist, Skip Hansen. You do a deep dive into his background and also his mother's background. So as you give us this complicated background that explains Skip Hansen, who's basically a hitman, why he turned out the way he did. We get to know the mother, the impact she's had on him. Talk about building that holistic antagonist.
Well, I didn't want Skip or any of my characters to be flat, you know, to be, just behavior, just shooting people, however exciting that may be. For me, when I read those kinds of characters, I'm not interested. And so what I wanted to do was give Skip depth, to give the reader the reasons why this young man became a hitman. I mean, that process, you've got to really experience a few things if you decide, well, this is my life's work. I'm gonna kill people for a living. And I wanted to explain that. And I think that even though he's a bad guy, I want the reader to invest in him, to at least be not sympathetic, but to understand that he had reasons for being a hitman. And you can invest in him because of his vulnerabilities, because of his very human vulnerabilities. And he's experienced incredible pain over his life. So that when Isaiah and Skip have a confrontation, you're invested in both sides. There may be, you know, you may be siding with Isaiah, but at least you know what's at stake for Skip, how momentous it is for him in his psychological state. So that it's a desperate thing to do for both of them. And I think what I try to do is intensify that conflict, you know, and to make it grow and get intense and serious and life-threatening. That was my intent with Skip.
To lighten the mood a little bit, I want to go back to the buttermilk fried chicken. Is there buttermilk fried chicken in Los Angeles? Is that real?
Well, there was.
You miss it?
My kindergarten teacher, Odile Huff, she used to, this was like kindergarten, she used to pick me up and walk me to school. And she was so kind. And I was such a whiny little bastard. And she was so kind to me. And as I grew older, you know, we stayed in touch. And I went to her house for some occasion, and she made, you know, buttermilk fried chicken. And I've never had fried chicken like that since, ever. I even had fried chicken, but, you know, hers was the best. I mean, it may be a memory, but I don't think so. You know, I was eating her food when, you know, when I was a teenager, when I was in high school. So I'm not making this up.
Wow.
Hers is the best, was the best. Yeah.
One of the things that I see in this story for me is the importance of community and the importance of not assuming you are all by yourself, and the importance of community supporting the loners they see in their community. How important was it for you to sort of bring that out, that community? Because sometimes I think of, there's this myth of the lone cowboy, the person that does it on their own. And it's a myth. Yeah. It's absolutely a myth. So, but we promote that in American popular culture for a while, that lone person who has no help, just does it on her own. There was a famous philosopher whose name escapes me, who sort of promoted that sort of objectivism. I think it was called her philosophy. I'm forgetting her name right now, but who had immigrated from Russia. Ayn Rand?
Yeah.
Ayn Rand.
She was one of them.
Yeah. One of them, right. And so she wrote The Fountainhead and some other books that promotes this individual fighting against the community. They're just holding him back, but he wants to build that tower. Yeah. And they made a movie out of that, actually. Patricia Neal was in that movie. And Gary Cooper was the architect. So talk about the conflict between individuality and going it on your own versus the importance of community.
Yes. Well, as I said, Isaiah is really afraid of relationships. He's afraid of being hurt, and he's afraid of people abandoning him. And so though he has people who love him, he hasn't been seen that way. You know, there are these people in the community who like me, including all of his ex-clients who all live locally. No, he doesn't know their depth of feeling for him, their appreciation. And so I bring these people together to help him through his crises. And I think, as you say, it's important to have a family of one kind or another. You know, it may not be your relatives, but it's important to have that family around you. Otherwise, you cannot survive. Not in reality, you can't. As you say, nobody goes it completely alone. And again, I try to write honestly in terms of the emotion.
You have a new character, Winnie Handel, and she has been assigned to help to solve the kidnapping of Grace. And of course, Isaiah IQ is like, stay out of my way. I'm going to go ahead and do my own thing. But you build a whole arc for this character. This isn't just like you said, it's just not a flat one-dimensional character. You give us some background. You talk about the conflict she has as an Asian police detective. So talk a bit about, number one, your decision to bring a new character in. And I'm assuming, you know, I've read all your IQ novels, but I don't have a photographic memory. But I'm sure you're always bringing in these new characters to sort of continue to build that world for IQ. So talk about Winnie Handel.
Well, she's going to come back. Maybe in her own series. I'm hoping she'll have her own series. Like Renee Ballard and the Renee Ballard character in Michael Connelly's books. And that's where I got the idea. I thought he was so skilled in terms of how he brought that character in and grew her over the books. And I wanted to do the same kinds of things. So between you and me, I'm writing the first Winnie book. And what it's done for me is it gives me a wider palette of experiences for her, because she's wealthy and because she's so skilled as an investigator. I can, over the course of the series, she can go anywhere. She also saw the case in Paris. know, she can deal with movie stars and celebrities, as well as keeping to her roots and dealing with problems, you know, in the hood or wherever. So I wanted that kind of range in a character. And there's only there's a certain kind of case that Isaiah takes. And I was happy with that, but I want to expand my own palette in terms of what I can write about. And so that's why I'm trying to write a Winnie series. And let's see what happens.
How has that experience been different from you writing IQ versus writing Winnie?
It's really the world. That's the difference, the world. She has a completely different world than he does. Her father's wealthy and she's wealthy and she's able to take advantage of that wealth. And she lives quite a great life, quite a luxurious life. And I wanted to, one of that was sort of a strategic move. I wanted to get away from the sort of, you know, blue collar kind of female detective. And I wanted a different experience for the reader. Not to say she's not compassionate or good at her job, but I wanted her to come to it with a different background as opposed to, you know, fiercely working her way up. And I wanted her to be in conflict with her fellow officers. And so she does things like she wears designer clothes to work. And this pisses a lot of people off and write her off as just a twit. But she's so good at her job, they can't deny her. You know, they can ostracize her for being rich and being, you know, wearing these clothes and driving a Lexus, but they cannot ostracize her based on her abilities. And, you know, I wanted to put her, like all characters, in a situation where there's conflict. There's conflict everywhere. And that was my thinking with Winnie.
And what I like is the way she knows she's smart, but her fellow officers and other people are saying IQ is smarter.
Yes.
How does that character feel to be coming up against an amateur sleuth who her peers are saying he's smarter than you?
Mm-hmm. She's competitive. She can't believe it. Really, really, this guy who accepts, you know, blueberry muffins as payment. I'm an experienced detective. No. And she's completely skeptical. You know, I mean, she grants that, okay, he's a smart guy, but I'm a detective. I earned my way to this spot right here. And there's simply no way this guy is smarter than me. So she not only wants to meet him and have him join her on her case, she's competing with him. You know, they're looking for Skip. They're looking for Skip, and it's sort of a race. Who's going to find Skip and Grace first? And you know, it's another way of continuing to build in conflict. You know, at every turn for Isaiah. And as you know, a novel is about a character overcoming obstacles and solving problems. And so I think about that whenever all the time while I'm writing, I'm thinking about where's the conflict in this scene? Where's the conflict in this character? How does this character ricochet off other characters? And that was my thinking with her. I had to write from a woman's point of view, which I think is sort of not small things, but I write her as a person. I just try to write her as a person. You know, she may wear a skirt, but she's a person. And so I tried to get into her head and write her based on her experiences. And My wife likes her.
I was going to ask, did your wife give you some feedback? Daughters to give you feedback on the character? Did anyone say, actually, you're wrong, Joe?
No. Well, I got a good bullshit detector right here in my house. So I'll probably do all right.
So Grace, actually, you have her character getting to know someone you're surprised she's going to get to know while in captivity. I don't want to reveal too much, but she gets to know a character that's in the book. And I thought that was pretty interesting that it wasn't a simple, she's kidnapped, she's isolated, she's by herself, trying to figure out how to escape. But you literally said, okay, let's throw another little twist in here. Let's get her to get to know another character while kidnapped. Was that sort of a organic kind of happening, or was that sort of planned in an outline?
Planned in the sense that I always want unusual relationships. It gives me unusual kinds of conflict, and it gives the readers something they may have not seen before. And so that's always in my thinking. And by the way, I don't outline.
You know, you're not the outliner.
I don't outline. I start with a vague idea and I just start writing. And I write page one and I write it as carefully as possible. And I rewrite the hell out of it because this is the standard. Nothing can be worse than page one. So page one informs page two, and two informs three. And I start writing in bigger increments, and I go forward in increments because if especially an aspiring writer looks forward and tries to figure out what's going to happen over the course of 300 pages, it's too much. It's just too much to think about. So I try to keep my writing problems contained, in a place where I can actually solve them. And after I write, say, 60 pages, I turn around, look back, and I see all the things that don't work. Maybe there's a subplot that's not contiguous, or I need another subplot, or the character isn't evolving. So I go back, I edit those 60 pages, and I get them more or less the way I like them. Then I start looking forward again. And because I've written those 60 pages, I can see more clearly what could happen as I keep writing. And I start to see other possibilities in terms of other characters and other subplots and other situations. And so I continue to do that. I go three steps forward and then two steps back. And it's an incredibly inefficient way to write. I wouldn't commend it to anybody, but it's a reflection of how my mind works. Maybe not my mind, but you know how you get good ideas after the fact?
Yes.
You don't have them right away. And then, you go through some things and then you go, man, I could have done this. I could have done that. And that's why I write that way. Because as I advance, I see possibilities. So I'll go back and I'll start adding in those things or taking things out. Yes. So I don't outline.
So do you, your inspiration to make changes, to redo things, does that solely come when you're at the table desk with the laptop, computer, notebook in front of you? Or are you ever out at dinner, at the movies, with friends, and literally just pops up in your mind, you know what, I need to make this change to the book?
Yes.
And how do you keep track of that when you're just out at dinner or at the movies?
I'm only organized on the page. I mean, the rest of my life is not in chaos. I'm detached from reality when I'm outside of writing. And it makes me, I take the wrong exit on the freeway. Last week, I went to the wrong doctor. Okay. I'm supposed to go to one doctor. I end up at another doctor. Jerry Seinfeld said, comedians are always thinking comedy. They're always looking for something that they can turn into funny. And it's the same with me. I'm always looking for something I can use in the book. I'm always listening to people talk. You know how you see two people in a parking lot at the grocery store and they're screaming at each other? And you sort of go around them, give them privacy. I go right up there. I go and get as close as I can without, you know, without actually joining the conversation. I want to hear these things. You know, as a writer, any writer, you're a student of human nature. That's your job. That's what you write about. So if I go to a social occasion, I'm not a participant. You know, I don't need to tell my five best anecdotes. You know, I'm a spy. I'm a spy. I'm watching people. I'm listening to people. And I'm trying to gather really intelligence about the very thing that I'm writing about, humans. And so I'm always looking. I'm always looking, or at least aware of the fact that that things happen that I could write about. Like I go to the 7-Eleven. And every time I go there, there's a bunch of rowdy kids in the parking lot, right? And they're really loud and they drink and they hassle people. And the manager of the 7-Eleven, Danny, he can't call the cops every 10 minutes, right? So the next time I go there, which was recent, parking lot's empty. No, and Danny is playing classical music through the outdoor speakers. And that's why the kids fled. Okay. Now, if Danny's the character, he's not just a storeman. Now, he's a smart storeman. And I've got the basis, you know, for a character. I'm trying to get on the freeway. There's a, you know, center island, and there's a homeless guy. He's a draggle shopping cart and all that stuff. And he's got his little cardboard sign. So I drive up next to him, and the sign doesn't say food. It says alcohol. And
oh, you're joking? Really?
Yeah. Yeah. So I rolled down the window. I gave him $1. I said, you know, at least you're honest. So if my character did that, it would say something about it, you know, and I suppose it says something about me. But I'm on the lookout for every little discrepancy, every little human thing. That's a big part of my job.
It reminds me of read a novel by Ivy Pacoda, and I think it opens with a naked jogger on the freeway.
There it is. There it is. Yes. Yes.
So then I did the research. Good. I'm like, did this really happen in Los Angeles? Like another example, and I think I found it did happen, but the homeless problem in Los Angeles is huge. And I didn't know that until I read Ivy Pacoda's novel.
Yes. Yes.
And one of the things I love about crime fiction writers, and I said this recently at the Austin Noir launch, is that I always like crime fiction writers that tell you the truth about what's going on in culture, what's going on in society. They're not sweeping the stories under the rug. They're not playing boosterism as if your city is perfect or these neighborhoods are perfect. You're bringing out, this is what I would say, this is the real deal. And how can you solve the problems of the city if you don't face reality?
Right. I try and set the book in a world or a community that actually reflects that community. I'm trying to make everything at least credible, because if the reader loses credibility, then you're done, just done. So I want to make the places real as possible. And that means writing about social problems. I'm not on a soapbox, but if my character has a certain opinion about, say, poverty or guns or whatever it is, because I write from point of view, I want that character to have a reasonable opinion, attitude about whatever the social problem is. And that also helps me fill in that character, because to a great extent, we are our attitudes, our opinions, and our ideas. And so that's another way I try to fill out a character and make them, at least on the page, seem real.
Well, Joe, I really enjoy your IQ novels. I'm really looking forward to your next IQ novel. And I got my fingers crossed. I do look forward to reading a Winnie Handel novel, because I do like, it's to me, it's sort of like that a lot of the stories, when you look at the movies, Boys in the Hood, you know, Menace to Society, they were providing one perspective of the Black community. But yes, that's not the only part of the Black community. There are wealthy people in the Black community. There are middle-class people in the Black community. And I always like writers that recognize that even within a culture or within a group, that there's a lot of variety within that group.
Yes, yes. And I think much of the Black world is seen as uniform. Everybody's a rapper. Everybody wants... as aspiring for millions of dollars to be a celebrity, or as violent, like Boys in the Hood.
Or basketball.
But, yeah. But that, again, that's just not true. It's simply not true. There are so many different viewpoints and attitudes in the Black community, as there are in any community. And I think that's what grates on me, is the community is not portrayed like any other community. Where people have diverse opinions and have diverse lifestyles. Go ahead.
But the other interesting thing I'm finding out, just because of social media, there's mm-hmm. so much content being put on by basketball players. And that's what I mostly follow on Instagram. And what I'm learning, what I really already knew, that these superstar athletes work incredibly hard at honing their skill set. That it's not, I got great talent, I'm just going to lackadaisical become a great player. Every one of these stories that you're reading about these basketball players, they have worked incredibly hard. And they share these stories about their routine and how they got out of, how they improved this process and that process and 5 days a week and three, that even, and so it sort of breaks in my mind, it breaks that stereotype of, oh, we got these talented athletes and it's just all about talent, because all these talented athletes also that I see on social media reveal how hard they're actually working to be successful.
Yes. Take Kobe or LeBron. Especially Kobe. This is just one of the hardest working people in history. I mean, he was incredibly hard on himself, and he had natural talent. But if he had not worked so hard and had not trained himself so hard, he would not have become the superstar he became. And like you say, a lot of athletes are portrayed as just having good chromosomes. But again, that's not true either. That's not true either. All the pro athletes work so hard and were so disciplined, because you have to be to get at that level. There's only 1,700 players in the NBA. All the basketball players in the world.
Now, I know you're an NBA fan when you can literally tell me how many players are in the NBA. So I do have to ask you. And so we're recording this interview on May 20th, and the Los Angeles Lakers are behind 2-0.
Yes.
Are you worried?
No, please. Anthony Davis and LeBron are on the same team. And I know the opposition has big guns, but I believe we will come through. I mean, they've only been winning by, And so I have faith. I have faith. The Lakers have kind of come back before. Now they have the team. So I have no worries, none.
But I'm going to put you on the spot. Who's the best player on the court right now when those two play?
The best player on the court?
Yeah, when those two play.
Yeah, is LeBron. Oh, LeBron.
Not the Joker?
No. Please.
He's averaging a triple-double.
Here's the thing. A good player, a great player, is a great player. And his performance, you judge him on his performance out there. And when I look at, who's the greatest player, I'm thinking about how does that player change the team? How does that player make his team better? And I believe LeBron has the edge there because he's such a he's so hard to guard and he's so powerful and all the rest of that stuff. He can dish the ball. And so he always has an option that makes other players better. And he's not always done that, but he's doing it now. And LeBron going away.
Wow. I'm gonna cut this part of the interview out. I'm gonna have Joe Ide and Hopton Hay talk NBA. Who's the best player? Well, Joe, it's always a pleasure to interview you. I look forward to your next IQ book. Joe Ide, author of Fix It. Y'all pick it up and read it. It's really good. Thanks for being a guest on Diverse Voices Book Review.
Thank you, Hopton. Anytime.
Thank you for listening to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopton Hay, host and producer. The theme music is provided by Wright Productions. You can follow the show on social media. Under Facebook and Instagram, it's Diverse Voices Book Review, or Twitter under @DiverseBooksHay.